This is the Edisto TV podcast, connecting the Blackwater region.
And welcome back once again to the Edisto TV podcast. I'm Hugo.
And I am Tom.
And this week we are going to be spending most of our time on a conversation we had with Bill Marshall of the South Carolina Department of Natural Resources. It follows up nicely on the content we had last week, combining segments we did with Ben Gregg, Vince Furtick, and Bob Guild. And Bill has what I think would probably be an almost unique perspective based on his job and his longtime personal connections to the Edisto River watershed. And we talked for over an hour, so we'll get started with it this week, but we'll have the rest in future episodes. And so, Tom, I know that we got a lot of good information from Bill in that conversation. What else is going on this week from the internet?
Well, some interesting articles on Edisto concerns that have generated some comments and shares and likes and so forth, but they all have to do with this coming apocalypse of water shortage. And the idea is that, you know, everybody is starting to realize that water is becoming a more and more precious commodity. And so we got a couple articles out there. There was one in particular from The Guardian, which was talking about Nestle and some other mega corporations that have made part of their strategy to find cheap or free water and then commoditize it and make some money off it.
In fact, I think that article included some comments that were quotes from a former Nestle CEO who was saying that people should be entitled to enough to survive on, but beyond that, water ought not be free.
Right. Yeah, and so also it mentioned the thing going on in Detroit. If you've heard the news in the last week or two, you know, the people in Detroit, I think about 15 or 20% have not been paying their water bills, and they finally kind of caught up with them as they're trying to balance their budget and turned off their water. And so people are protesting, saying, hey, water's a right. So it started a conversation, at least, to say, do I have a right to water or not?
Yeah, and there are real ties here to sort of fairly deep-running economic and environmental issues about ownership and access, and a lot of the sort of stuff that we've been talking about in the context of the Edisto is written all across the face of this issue in other places. I think I also pointed out to you the Toilet to Tap initiative.
I just posted that article a few minutes ago. But yeah, the idea is that if you're downstream of a city and there's a low flow period in your river, a lot of those cities are basically using recycled wastewater and sending it downriver. And so if you're downstream, you're going to be probably drinking somebody's wastewater.
Well, bringing it all right home, at the head of the South Fork, you've got the city of Johnston. Their wastewater plant goes straight into the headwaters of the South Fork. Over in Batesburg-Leesville, their wastewater plant into Duncan Creek, down Chincapin Creek, headwaters of the North Fork. So anywhere on both forks of the Edisto, it starts with water treatment. And then downstream on the North Fork, you've got Orangeburg taking their city water from the river for the most part, and then putting their treated wastewater back in the river where it goes downstream to be Charleston's drinking water.
Right.
So it's important to think about how water treatment gets done. I thought that the article that we linked from the Huffington Post was interesting because the author's basic premise is that if you are doing toilet-to-tap retreatment of used water, that you're probably getting cleaner water from that process than you get drawing used output water from upstream municipalities as your water source from a river. So, again, something that ties to the issues that we've been talking about.
Absolutely. We definitely need to be thinking about where we're going to be in 50 years.
Okay, and there was one other article that I posted a link to it on the Edisto Concerns page, the one about the aquifer injection stuff down in Georgia, where they had apparently a law that prevented injection of water to recharge aquifers directly, and now that law has lapsed. Some interesting stuff going on there, and again, the whole issue of water and how we deal with it and how we store it and use it, it's all tied together there.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I never even really heard about that before, but, you know, we always taking water out of the ground, but I never heard people pumping it back in, but that's what they're talking about, and there's certainly some risks to that, I think, is what they're saying is, you know, bacteria or whatever, things that occur naturally above ground that when you pump that back down in there, you may not have the effect desired.
Yeah, I know you and I have both talked at various times informally with my good friend Bruce Campbell from the USGS about groundwater stuff. Maybe we get Bruce on one of these coming weeks and try to talk to him a bit about some of these groundwater issues.
Definitely.
Okay, well, with that as a starting point, we're going to take a quick break, then we're going to come back and jump right into the phone conversation with Bill Marshall. So stay with us here on the Edisto TV podcast.
Hey, this is Tom from Edisto TV letting you know a couple big things going on at Tyler Brothers. First of all, it's the end of summer clearance sale, so if it's a short sleeve, it's on sale. We've got savings up to 60% on various Carhartt and other clothing lines. And it's deer season, so that means cash back on rifles and shotguns from Browning and Winchester. Check them out online at tylerbrothers.net or visit the store in downtown Wagner.
And we're back on the Edisto TV podcast. And let's jump right into this interview that we did with Bill Marshall of the Department of Natural Resources. Bill was nice enough to come out and spend the entire day at the Blackwater Fest back in June doing a sort of platform presentation about the Surface Water Withdrawal Act and some of the issues surrounding it. And I thought that what he was doing was very interesting, and he has a wealth of knowledge about the Edisto going back 20, 30 years. So I thought it was really appropriate that we have him on to talk about some of those things. Tom, anything you'd like to say before we jump into there?
Yeah, well, just that Bill was involved in this Edisto River study group that they did back in the mid-90s, and that kind of set the tone for a lot of research and a lot of data that was collected during that period. And so anyway, he'll tell us about that, but he's been studying the Edisto River Basin and water in South Carolina as long as anybody around.
Yeah, and he is, I think, the guy in charge of the South Carolina Scenic Rivers Program as well, so he knows what he's talking about. And so for the most part, the next half hour, we're going to let him tell us what he knows rather than running our mouths. So here it is, our interview with Bill Marshall on the Edisto TV podcast.
Tom and Hugo, good to be with y'all today. Yeah, Bill Marshall, I work with the South Carolina Department of Natural Resources. I'm within the Land, Water, and Conservation Division of the DNR. My work duties are in a realm of, it pretty much captures rivers in various ways. I have responsibility for the state scenic rivers program. We have 10 state scenic rivers around the state, and in that role, I'm also involved with river projects, river conservation projects at other capacities. Edisto is one of those. Other realm of responsibility is within hydro relicensing or hydro licensing. There's a federal law, the Federal Power Act, that regulates private hydroelectric projects. We have about 25 in the state of South Carolina, and I'm the coordinator for the state of South Carolina for the DNR, representing the DNR in the licensing proceedings and the various management issues associated with those licenses that. Where I coordinate the DNR's input to those matters. So we provide input to license provisions and management of these hydro projects under those federal licenses. So that's a whole other realm that occupies a great deal of my time. But back on the river conservation side, that's the realm of which I got involved with the Edisto back in the late 1980s, I guess it was around 88, I started working with what was then the Water Resources Commission on something called the Edisto River Basin Project, and that was a federally funded research and demonstration project. It involved mapping and then also developing a sort of a public planning process utilizing the map information. It was geographic information systems. Utilizing that technology and the map information to see how that kind of data could maybe improve natural resources decision making and policy development. So we developed map products for the Edisto, and we conducted a public planning process. We created a group of volunteers called the Edisto River Basin Task Force, and we produced different study reports, but probably the most significant thing was the Edisto River Basin Project report of the task force, and it's a document that's out on the internet, thanks to Tom getting it out there, and it's on the Friends of the Edisto site. But it's a report of the task force, addresses a wide range of issues, resource management issues in the Edisto River Basin and the entire watershed. So it addresses ecological resource protection and management, as well as cultural resources and economic resources. So it attempts to identify areas of significance or importance to different kinds of user interests, and then identify management goals and recommendations on how to better manage, protect, and care for those resources, and sort of balance the competing interests between economic development and resource conservation or protection management. So that all that transpired, and that work with the Edisto happened, starting in the early 80s and through the middle 90s. That report I just described was published in 1996. And then soon thereafter, after the Edisto River Basin Task Force accomplished that bit of work, it essentially disbanded, in the sense that our funding was drying up, and we were definitely in a transition period after 1996. And so one of the steps that the members of the task force who were really interested in going forward with all this good information they produced, the objective was to create a private nonprofit to promote the Edisto River Basin Project report, the recommendations of the task force. So that organization ultimately became Friends of the Edisto. I think Friends of the Edisto was founded in 1998, if I remember correctly. So it's a byproduct or an outcome of the Edisto River Basin Task Force work. So being a staff person who supported the task force, it was natural for me to continue to be involved in promoting all the work that we did and be involved with Friends of the Edisto to do that. And so started, being involved with Friends of the Edisto way back and have supported it all along the way. And we've had the trials and tribulations of any private nonprofit, just trying to figure out how to develop membership and funding and decide among a number of priorities how to pursue certain objectives. So we've done a variety of things with Friends of the Edisto over the years, and more recently, it was Tim Rogers who actually instigated the creation of Friends of the Edisto back in 1998. And Tim was a board member all along. But in recent years, we've gotten more. We found some funding sources and have gotten more engaged. And I think with the water withdrawal issue coming on the scene last year, that's really ramped up interest in Friends of the Edisto organization. And in any case, that's some background on that.
Do you feel like the 20 years following the study have taken full advantage of the work that the commission did, or just how do you assess how things have worked out since then?
Back in the middle 1990s, I was saying, it was more data generated for the Edisto watershed than any other watershed in the state at that time. And the shortcoming was that it's not a delicate way to say it, but there wasn't a great demand for the information in that part of the world. Typically As well, so one of the things that people would say about the Edisto is, well, you know, we know that it's still in good shape. Nobody's really messed it up yet. So our real priority is to try to keep it intact, because we've verified back with all that work we did in the 90s that it is, you know, that an intact system, a watershed that it doesn't have a lot of development on the landscape, and it's a free-flowing stream, and you know, have a lot of ecological functions that still operate the way that nature originally established them, and mankind hadn't come in there and altered it a whole lot. Now, of course, you know, there's certainly alterations, and you know, there was issues with ditching and draining, or conversion of timber from one kind to another, all those sorts of things were talked about. But in terms of the landscape being heavily developed, it wasn't. But because it's a rural part of the world, and there wasn't a lot of development pressure, there wasn't a great demand for the kind of information we produced, and so it wasn't really embraced. But, you know, to be fair, I mean, there were counties like Orangeburg and Aiken in Lexington that looked at the data we produced and tried to incorporate it into some of their comprehensive plans. Those were sort of plans that would help direct development and land use planning in those counties. To what, you know, in terms of whatever planning goes on in those counties, they all had to produce comprehensive plans to form a basis for things that they would do. That information we produced, the Edisto River Basin Project Report and all the maps, were incorporated into some of the comprehensive plans. But still, there wasn't great development pressures to embrace the data, to use it to guide development. So some critics of what we did said, you know, you should have gone to a more developed place where the data were, you know, this information, the data and the process was more needed. But so that's one perspective on the Edisto. And interestingly, you know, we've been talking a lot about water withdrawals. Back in those days in the 90s, water withdrawals issues were, you know, not the, you know, top of the list. We understood we had a lot of agriculture in the region. We knew we had a large municipality that would take water over to Charleston, but other than that, the river was seen to be in good condition in a hydrologic viewpoint. The sand hills receive a lot of receive rain and present a good reserve of groundwater base flow to the upper end of the basin, and that tended to make the Edisto a stream that was in good shape from a hydrologic standpoint. So some of the land use issues were what were of interest in the old days, back in the 1990s. How do we keep the rural natural landscape intact to continue to support, you know, provide the habitat and the water quality that everybody values.
So, Bill, one part of that report that I look at from time to time is the economic development area, and I'm just kind of curious about your thoughts, because it is a very rural area, and it is still kind of high poverty levels relative to the rest of the state, and I'm just kind of curious on the economic development front. You've heard our vision of with Edisto TV of putting up towers and bringing broadband internet. Just kind of curious about your opinion about that and other efforts for economic development in this region. How do you view those?
Some of the more innovative thinking about economic development back when we were involved with the project, the Edisto River Basin Project, where, you know, I know that some of the economic development leaders of the state do think this way. You know, how does what is the niche for the Edisto River Basin? What do they do best, and how do we enhance that, add value to it? And back in those days, it was often thought that some of the agricultural products and the wood products, forest products, presented some of the best opportunities to add value to things, you know, to resources coming off the land. So I was involved with some research efforts that came out of the College of Engineering at University of South Carolina to look at, you know, enhancing wood products and some interesting concepts about industrial, different ways to improve industrial processes around wood products. That was one. From a land conservation standpoint, we were always encouraging local governments to constrain their interest in expanding infrastructure that would cause, you know, kind of this notion of sprawling. You send pipelines for water or sewer or one thing out down a U.S. highway, it's not long before you see all kinds of developments sprawling out there along with those, with that kind of infrastructure. So one idea, one concept that we promoted was, you know, containment. You know, try to build within a, say, compact if possible. Don't sprawl out like the typical American pattern is. But in terms of what you just mentioned, the internet infrastructure, that's a perfect example of a very positive type of infrastructure to support economic development in rural South Carolina. From my perspective, I think it wasn't even thought of, I don't think dreamed of back in the middle 1990s, but it's certainly in the spirit of the kinds of things that were thought about back in those days, providing resources that would, you know, inspire or equip entrepreneurs to do things that would provide jobs and provide opportunities within these rural areas. So I think you're right on target with, you know, a positive resource for economic development with the internet enhancements that you've been talking about.
Hey, this is Tom from Edisto TV, welcoming our new sponsor, the Black River Chop House in Orangeburg, recently voted by the Times and Democrat as the best place for a cocktail, best place for nightlife. Check out the team over there at the Black River Chop House in Orangeburg Mall. Great place to go when you're thirsty, great place to go with some old friends, or go meet some new ones. Black River Chop House, quality food and spirits in the heart of Orangeburg.
Let's jump right back into the interview that we did earlier this week with Bill Marshall here on the Edisto TV podcast.
Talking to Ben Gregg and also to Bob Guild, they referred to money that has been put aside in the legislature for study that they're hoping is coming to the Edisto Basin. Is that the same thing that we're talking about there?
I believe it is. I believe they were talking about the modeling, the river basin modeling. It's a hydrologic modeling. It's basically understanding the water resources you have, the stream flow that you have, and understanding the, you know, tool to look at the water use and water availability, and you kind of look at it through seasons and over time, and it helps you. It's a tool to better understand how to manage the water, the available water that you have, and, you know, surface water that you have in those streams. So it is a model, and I believe that is what they were talking about. And I think the legislature allotted about $2 million for South Carolina, and so it's a shoestring budget to try to address modeling for the state, the whole state of South Carolina, but I guess our consultant, the contractor, will be doing the best we can with that, and hopefully we'll get some more money along the way to you know, produce even better models as we go forward. But that's a whole realm that I'm not directly plugged into, so I'm just kind of speaking from a distant observer.
I understand. Let me go in a slightly different direction. If we're spending $2 million to model watersheds, and there was the whole effort in the Edisto Basin that was the work of the task force 20 years ago, and there's been all along this seemingly fairly enlightened and aware effort to figure out what water resources we have and what to do with them, how is it possible that the existing Surface Water Withdrawal Act pays absolutely no attention to this? And for instance, the DHEC process, and I know you're not with DHEC, but the DHEC process leaves no option in the agricultural registration realm for them to even take advantage of this sort of information. It's a straight how much water is in the bucket calculation. How something like that happened? And I guess rather than asking existential questions, what do we do about it?
Yeah. Yeah, South Carolina has a diverse diverse population with a lot of different interests, and I think those who had the most influence on the development of the act had the interest of their interests in mind, their water use interest in mind, and so I think that those who had more interest in developing policy to protect streams, ecological functions of streams, didn't have a strong voice at the table. So that's the way that went down, I believe. And those of us who care about streams and the protection of, the ecological functions of streams, fish and wildlife of streams, we just got to make our voices heard and try to influence policy better as we go forward. But my take on the Surface Water Act is it was, you had interest in water use that pretty much crafted that thing to take care of their interest, and that was how it was constructed. When you look at that statute, it doesn't have much policy statement at all. It's pretty much just divvies up rights to water and creates some administrative structure, and that's about it. Doesn't affirm public values for water or public interest in streams in any way, like sharing of water resources. It just doesn't affirm some of those maybe common law values that you might think of in water resources, sharing of the resource, protection of in-stream values, ecological values of streams or downstream, managing water use in a way that protects your neighbor or doesn't have an ill effect on your neighbor. Anyway, it's essentially some procedures and some allotment of rights to water. That's the way I see it.
So there you have it, the first half hour or so of our conversation we had with Bill Marshall. Tom, I think that, basically that what Bill's talking about here is very much what we're here to talk about. So I'm pleased that we got him on.
Yeah, it was great. And also trying to figure out how are we going to take all this information that we're gaining, through this podcast and these interviews, and how are we going to put this together in such a way that a legislator can look at some kind of a fact sheet or whatever he needs to say, all right, here's what we need to do to change these laws. And so I know there are some working groups right now that are starting to talk about how we're going to change this law. But I really see the challenge for the next 6 months is getting the message out in a succinct form to legislators so that they can make a real easy decision about what we do to change this law.
Yeah, and I do know that there are several groups right now working on their agendas for the coming legislative session beginning in January of 2015. So now is the time to get it together, and I agree, we need to We need to press the people who are in these various groups to come together, share information, and come out with a cohesive and reasonable set of asks for our legislators to follow up on. All right. And on that positive note, we will wrap up this week's episode of the Edisto TV podcast. Say goodbye, Tom.
Goodbye.
All right. We'll see you next week.
This is the Edisto TV podcast, produced by Edisto TV, connecting the Blackwater region.